Hi, everybody. I'm John Federson from the North Carolina Reading Service with this week's edition of The Independent, the Indie Week. As of all our programs, it's meant for our blind and print-impaired listeners, and the date of this issue, September the 18th of 2024. Well, our first article is really statewide because it involves the governor's race campaign this year. Anyone strolling through Raleigh this weekend may hear the voice of Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson blasting from an electronic billboard on the side of a truck. MLK was a communist, the voice says, speaking over an image of himself pointing into the face of the revered leader. And the civil rights movement was crap, he adds, edited into the bus seat next to Rosa Parks. On another slide, his voice calls the Affordable Care Act an effort to enslave everybody, while he poses, tin hat perched on his bald head in front of an Illuminati conspiracy board. But Robinson, the Republican candidate for governor, did not sit down to record those lines for the ads. The sounds weren't even spliced together from past clips. Instead, his voice was digitally created to read quotes and beliefs taken from old Facebook posts, rallies, and media appearances with artificial intelligence. The campaign is the latest form, Americans for Prosperity, not to be confused with Koch brothers-backed Americans for Prosperity, a satire political action committee founded and funded by Raleigh millionaire and activist Todd Stiefel. Too many people aren't familiar with the crazy things that have come out of Robinson's mouth, says Stiefel in a press release. These billboards will help educate voters about just how extreme, dangerous, and downright weird he is. Even by the standards of a political communications world ravaged by Donald Trump and the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, the ads running in Raleigh are pretty wild. But the Americans for Prosperity ads that didn't make it onto the truck are even more jaw-dropping. In one, Robinson, in a red onesie with devil horns and wings, confesses that he is a murderer because he paid for his now wife's abortion. In another, he holds a severed head and a cross and tells the viewer, "Take the head of your enemy in God's name." All four ads are running on Facebook. Stiefel tells Indy the truck company, worried about the safety of their personnel, declined to run the abortion and severed head ads. During the spring primary, Americans for Prosperity ran several similar ads, focused on Robinson before he was officially the nominee. Those ads featured the more cartoonish Mark Rottenson character, with a villainous mustache and an old-timey hat. According to PAC filings, these mobile billboards cost $66,000. Stiefel said, "I wanted it to be as obvious as possible that Rotterson was parody and satire." But the PAC quickly ran into another problem. Lieutenant Governor isn't exactly a position with a lot of star power, so many people didn't know who Robinson was or wouldn't have recognized his likeness to begin with. That's why the current campaign features Robinson without any props. It also means the PAC has to be more careful about the script it writes for the AI voice, as the imitation is certainly good enough to make a passerby stop and wonder if Robinson really said that. For the most part, Robinson did. But by using some real quotes alongside some satirical content, all in Robinson's AI voice, some of the ads blur the line between reality and parody. In March, that debatable distinction had both Democrats and Republicans speaking out against the Rottenson campaign. Democratic candidate Josh Stein's campaign told WRAL, quote, "Any use of AI to mislead voters is unequivocally wrong and has no place in this campaign." While Robinson campaign spokesperson Michael Lonergan told Indy, Stiefel's low-rent website is full of fake clips and outrageous lies. North Carolina voters will see right through it. He also called the site a typical Democrat smear campaign and pointed out that Stiefel is a major Stein donor. He's an unaffiliated voter, but has donated at least $40,000 to Democratic candidates in PAC. In 2024 alone, and at least $18,000 to Stein since 2016. For one 2023 donation, Stiefel listed his occupation as provocateur. He says the current billboard campaign costs $23,000 and will run through the month. The press release noted the ads are, quote, part of a larger buy to be announced in the coming days. All right, and we'll go local now to the city of Raleigh. The city of Raleigh and Wake County have agreed to invest $32 million toward the construction of three new affordable housing developments in Raleigh. Together, the projects will create 454 new units of affordable rental housing in the coming years. By supporting these projects, the city and county are honoring commitments they've made to expand their affordable housing stock. In 2016, Raleigh set a goal of creating 5,700 affordable units by 2026 and is tracking its progress on a dashboard. That dashboard, by the way, is available if you went to IndyWeek.com and looked for these articles. Wake County, meanwhile, aims to create and preserve 2,500 affordables by 2029 and has reportedly already surpassed that goal. Despite this progress, demand for affordable housing continues to far exceed supply. Wake County is on a fast growth track, adding 64 new residents each day, and although housing prices and inflation have cooled since the height of the pandemic, affordable units remain especially hard to come by for prospective renters. The three new affordable developments coming to Raleigh are Maple Ridge Apartments in the northwest, Strickland Apartments in the southeast, and Moore Square Apartments downtown. The developers behind these projects, South Creek Development, Opidan Investment, and Harmony Housing Affordable Development, hope to begin construction by the end of this year. 2025. Maple Ridge, located at 500 Rawls Drive, presents 146 affordable rental units, a mix of 1, 2, and 3-bedroom apartments, rents ranging from $300 to $1,800 per month. 30 supportive housing units for people with disabilities or people experiencing homelessness. Raleigh contributes $3.1 million to this project, and Wake County contributing another $3 million. Strickland Apartments, located 13,000 Strickland Road, 148 affordable rental units, a mix of 1, 2, and 3-bedroom. Rents range from $330 to $1,700 per month. 30 supportive housing units for disabilities or homeless people. Raleigh contributes $4 million, and Wake County contributes $3 million. And the third one I listed, I'm just fumbling through my page, is Moore Square Apartments. That's right on East Martin Street downtown, 300 East Martin. 160 affordable units, 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms. Rents $568 to $2,200 per month. 32 supportive housing units. And Raleigh contributes $15.7 million to this project. Wake County, another $3.3 million. All these developments will be income restricted. The most expensive units will be open to anyone earning 70% or less of the area median income, AMI, and the least expensive units will be reserved for people earning 20% or less of AMI. More details about how the units in each building will be priced are available at, again, the IndyWeek.com article. Raleigh and Wake County's contributions to these projects take the form of low-interest loans to be paid back with 1 to 1.5% interest over the next 30 to 40 years. In addition to requesting government support, the developers are taking out bank loans and receiving tax credits from the IRS Low Income Housing Tax Credit Program. That is the program behind most new affordable housing created in the U.S. and North Carolina. County and city officials were enthusiastic about the funding requests and approved them unanimously at their respective meetings on Monday and Tuesday. All right, and now a much longer article from Raleigh. Will Raleigh's next mayor and city council continue on the same pro-growth trajectory? Raleigh's housing plight is a familiar subject for many. Whether you live downtown or outside the I-440 Beltline, own or rent, earn five figures or minimum wage, stable housing is hard to come by. And while the housing market has recovered somewhat from the skyrocketing costs during the COVID pandemic, the crisis is ongoing. Pat Young, director of Raleigh's Planning and Development Department, says the increases that we saw from 2020 to 22 were unprecedented. Since mid to late 22, about 2 years, it's been pretty flat. Values have not gone down, but they haven't gone up. The main issue now is that interest rates and terms and conditions for financing new developments are really challenging. We are seeing a little bit of slowdown in construction because projects in Raleigh are a little more expensive. With the city's population continuing to boom, up nearly 150,000 people, or 10% since from 2020 to 23, keeping up with demand for affordable housing is a constant struggle. Despite officials' best efforts, demand continues to outweigh supply, inflating prices, and spurring bidding wars. Building more affordable housing has been a priority for Raleigh Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin since her election in 2019. She supported the passage of an $80 million affordable housing bond in 2020 and enacted her signature missing middle policy in 21. Baldwin faced pushback in 22, however, with new council members raising concerns about how increased development impacts historic neighborhoods, aging infrastructure, and the environment. Over the years, community members and activists have also raised concerns about gentrification. The availability of affordable housing for middle-income residents, like teachers and firefighters, and the increasing rates of homelessness. The municipal election in November could determine whether the City Council will continue on its pro-development trajectory or face more resistance. Residents will vote in an open mayoral race and for candidates in all seven of the City Council seats. As Election Day approaches, the Indy took a look at the housing market from the perspectives of Raleigh residents, a young couple looking to buy, a renter in her early 20s, and a mother experiencing homelessness. All right, the first section, buying a house. On a Saturday afternoon in September, longtime partners Lexi Babcock and Forrest Mattingly roam through a small two-story house in North Raleigh, quietly assessing immaculate carpets alongside used appliances. Babcock murmurs to her boyfriend, "The floors are nice. You could resand them if you want." Upstairs, she's less impressed by the size of the bedrooms, although one could make a nice nursery, she notes. As the couple wander around, they fill in more details, imagining what the now bare house would look like as their future home. Babcock and Mattingly are two of the many northerners who've migrated south to Raleigh, finding the city more welcoming, less gridlocked, and more and less expensive than Philadelphia, their former home. The couple moved 7 months ago for Babcock's job, and while they are currently renting, they are in the market for a new house. Babcock says, "We're definitely looking for a single-family home and probably something we could grow in. We're looking to get married, have kids." The couple feels like they're in a good position to buy. They started early, Mattingly says, purchasing their first house when both were in their mid-20s. Thanks to low interest rates during the pandemic, the amount of equity they put in and the nearly doubled value of their home selling that house has given them an opportunity to upgrade. And while the two are in a good financial position, the Raleigh housing market is still difficult to navigate. Mattingly says the pricing is definitely a little crazy. There are a lot of houses that are $400K, and it's like, for what? It's a box. And if you want to be in a really nice area, it's, all right, do you have $1 million? No? Don't look over here. The city's efforts to increase supply and variety of housing through missing middle is going well, according to Young. The number of townhouses, duplexes, and other small homes built under the new zoning rules outpaces similarly sized peer cities like Minneapolis and Portland, he says. And this housing is built specifically with people like Babcock and Mattingly in mind. Young says the new housing soaks up demand from a lot of these wealthier folks that are moving into our region. And it opens up other housing in the market because there is less competition. It's very indirect, and it's a long game strategy, but it's crucially important. If we don't do it, we're guaranteed to have no organically affordable housing in 15 or 20 years. The housing constructed under missing middle is definitely within the couple's price range, but Babcock and Mattingly may be the exception to the rule. They aren't looking for a $400,000 duplex downtown, like the new ones at Millbank Village Court, or a $280,000 townhouse on the outskirts of the city, like those off Rock Quarry Road. The couple's old townhouse wasn't really big enough for their 100-pound dog, says Mattingly. Now they're excited to find a quiet place with a big backyard. Ideally, the two would prefer a house with some historic character, Mattingly says, which rules out many of the more affordable, newly built single-family homes outside the Beltline. What's left are million-dollar homes in Oakwood or older houses outside city center that fall into the category of naturally occurring affordable housing, which has become increasingly rare. Still, with more houses going on the market this year, listings are up 10% as of August. Compared with August last year, the couple feels like they do have options as the market does cool down. Babcock says it feels like it's getting better. If you asked us a year, even 6 months ago, it would have been like, I don't know if we'll be able to get a house here. The next segment talks about the life of a renter. Meanwhile, in downtown Raleigh, 24-year-old Jenny Chang is getting a cup of coffee. Unlike Babcock and Mattingly, she's in no position to buy. The graduate student has rented a one-bedroom apartment in an older complex for the past 2 years. When she first moved to Raleigh, she didn't have a lot of time to find a new place. She heard about her current complex from her sister, who had lived there when rents were a lot cheaper. Cheng was surprised to see the higher rates, but she was on a timetable, so she went ahead and moved in. She says, I wasn't expecting to pay as much as I did for the one bedroom I lived in. I did look at a couple of other complexes, but the time frame of moving was just not flexible. My sister's place had availability around the time I needed to move. Apartments with reasonable rents remain scarce in Raleigh, despite the city and county taking action to preserve affordable complexes like downtown's Grosvenor Gardens. The city is also buying land near major transit corridors in an effort to help developers construct low-cost housing with below-market-rate rent. Wake County offers emergency rental and utility assistance to help prevent displacement, but these programs are more aimed at lower-income renters at high risk of eviction or homelessness. The city and county are trying to stretch their money as far as possible, but many residents still fall through the cracks. Middle-income residents often struggle to find affordable apartments that are close to where they work. Chang experienced this firsthand. As a former private school teacher, her salary did impact where I was looking for housing, she says. I got paid more than a first-year public school teacher, but even then I was still struggling to make rent every month, even though I made a decent amount. It's a familiar refrain for renters, especially as landlords increase rates each year. Thankfully, Cheng was able to move into a different, cheaper unit this summer, she says, and she's locked into a 15-month lease now, and overall her experience has been good. Since the complex is a little older, she's occasionally had issues with plumbing or other systems, but maintenance has been responsive, she says. That's a major point in the pro column, as other renters have reported management ignoring serious maintenance issues in aging but more affordable apartment complexes. Cheng doesn't plan on moving anytime soon, but as always, it will depend on what happens when her lease is up. Her experience is in line with data that show that overall rents in Raleigh have been on the decline as more housing hits the market. According to recent rental price data from Zumper, a digital marketplace for renters and managers, median rents in August clocked in at $1,260 for a one-bedroom and $1,560 for a two-bedroom rental. That's down 9.4% and 4.9%, respectively, over last year. The final segment, living with homelessness. Kara Sanders, or Kay, is a community activist, former member of a joint Wake County Raleigh task force, and a one-time consultant for North Carolina State University. Day to day, she's usually at the park or public library with her 8-year-old son, Wisdom, or showing up at Raleigh City Council meetings to make public comments. She's also currently unhoused. Sanders moved from Connecticut to Raleigh around 2020, looking for support from her family. When that fell through, she found herself with no place to go. Since becoming unhoused, she and Wisdom have had pockets of stability, she says, but it never lasts. I've had people invite us to stay with them, tell us, welcome home, and then because they were going to be gone for the holiday weekend and we didn't have a place to go, they asked us to leave, says Sanders. We've been gifted hotel nights or things of that nature. We panhandled our way and stayed at a hotel for 3 or 4 months. Somebody gave us a car last year, and so that's where we're living now. Sanders has experienced both acts of radical kindness and persistent unkindness from strangers, she says. People have given her money, resources, even helped her pay for parenting classes. But when others learn she is unhoused, their treatment of her often shifts, she said. Last month, someone who saw her panhandling outside of Wegmans called Child Protective Services. Somebody was that concerned about my son that when they said, if you're here calling to report abuse or neglect, click this number, they felt that, Sanders said, we've had a lot of people mistreat us. To be unhoused is very trauma-filled. Shelters and nonprofits in Raleigh offer help to residents experiencing homelessness, but after 5 years of jumping through hoops, shuffling from one program to another, Sanders says, I realized that nobody was going to help. They were just trying to move people from one level of poverty to another. Trying to get into programs and access resources created so much stress that it pushed Sanders into fight-or-flight mode, she says. They keep you in such a state of, you need to do this, you need to do this now, you need to do this when I tell you, you need to jump, she says. They're not trauma-informed programs, so I can't. Wake County largely takes the lead on addressing homelessness, but the city has taken some steps forward, particularly during the last year. The city's ACORNS unit housed inside the police department, has responded to multiple calls for people experiencing homelessness or mental health issues, connecting them with social workers who can manage individual cases over time. In May, Raleigh City Council approved a new $5 million pilot program to provide direct rent assistance to about 45 households experiencing homelessness, as well as maintain and expand city-owned housing for these people. More than $12 million from the 2020 affordable housing has also been spent to fight homelessness, and this includes $7 million for the construction of Kings Ridge, a 100-unit apartment complex reserved for people exiting homelessness, $3 million to renovate and expand Healing Transitions, a recovery center for people dealing with addiction, and $2 million for the construction of 27 new apartments by Southeast Raleigh Promise, at least one-third of which must be affordable to people making 30% or less of the area median income, or about $26,000 for one person. And the City of Raleigh purchased the old Department of Motor Vehicles building on New Bern Avenue. It could potentially be used for housing. Still some, including Sanders, question the city's dedication to addressing homelessness. Activists have repeatedly petitioned the city to shift money from middle-class housing to programs that will help the city's most vulnerable. In Sanders' eyes, homelessness is, quote, solvable at the rate we have it right now. Officials simply lack the political will to fight it in a more significant way, she argues. Now, from Raleigh, there was another article produced a few days ago. Raleigh City Council considers the Red Hat Amphitheater relocation. Does it have the votes to approve the move? And this retained the details of that. However, I have taken the time to look up the news, and the Raleigh City Council has indeed made a decision in this, and I'll just outline it for you briefly. Basically, and this is from WRAL.com News, the Raleigh City Council approved the decision in a unanimous vote during an afternoon work session, that's on Tuesday, to move Red Hat Amphitheater in 2023. Well, that's not right, 2023. Raleigh City Council approved that plan. Council members approved the plan in a unanimous vote. Excuse me, I'm going to stop this and double-check my dates. All right, this must be a misprint to move the Red Hat, probably 2025. The vote was unanimous. Mary Ann Baldwin, the mayor, a staunch supporter of the project, was relieved that they made this decision. And several residents attended to voice their support for the project. There were several alternatives, which I won't bother to do. But however, the current capacity is close to 6,000 people, and the new location will be on West Lenore Street, and relocation will be completed by the start of the concert season in 2026. So there was vehement opposition to this. In fact, the council seemed to be locked 4-4. However, we know now that that is going to happen at some cost, I might add. And so I'll just skip now and move on to another article. And finally, we get over to Durham, then the Durham Public Schools, and they have started their school year with a bus driver shortage. Parents calling Durham Public Schools Transportation Services Department recently with questions about their child's school bus may have trouble getting through. Why? 10 members of transportation's administrative staff have left their posts to help drive the buses. At a DPS work session on Thursday, Anthony Lewis, school's new superintendent, acknowledged trouble in the first few weeks of the school year, citing increased ridership and a bus driver shortage. "Let me be clear," said Lewis. "These are not excuses. I do think it's hugely important for everyone in this community to know the current reality, and it's hugely important for everyone to know what we're doing about some of these challenges." Since the board's August work session, rider requests increased by almost 5,000 students, said the superintendent. Meanwhile, the district is short 30 bus drivers. Matthew Palmer, senior executive of school planning and operational services, said in response to an inquiry. 32 candidates are in the queue for training and testing, a process which should take approximately 2 months, said Lewis. The system has also hired 9 contractors to help with transportation communication. Now, the driver shortage is causing headaches for DPS parents like Jane Dorneman, whose son takes the bus to school each day. She said in an interview, "Consistently, and I mean almost every day, either the bus doesn't stop for him, the bus doesn't show up, or we get a message a bus is 2 hours late. The other issue is my son is also consistently waiting for the bus downtown for up to 2 hours. He most of the time gets home by 6 o'clock, and his school lets out at 3:20. Alongside the driver shortage, parents, including Lewis himself, have struggled to use the bus tracking system, which is called EduLog Parent Portal App. Lewis said, "Some of our parents have not been able to consistently see the buses in this app. I'm one of those parents that have not been able to see that consistently." Dorneman, the DPS parent, expressed frustration with EduLog during public comment earlier in the evening, calling on the board to replace EduLog immediately. It's not reliable. Multiple school districts across the country have dropped it for this reason and even taken EduLog to court and won. And another education article, sort of, in Chatham County. It's arts education this time. The article says that Mike Wiley, a professional actor, playwright, and director, has been visiting students in Chatham County Public Schools for 13 years. A few years ago, he was working with a student who was struggling to deliver some lines from a creative writing exercise. "Hold on," Wiley says, he told the student. "Just imagine you're out on the playground shouting to your friend, reciting this piece of poetry." That normally shy student ending up delivering a performance that was so loud and powerful that Wiley says the teacher was brought to tears. Now the county's Arts Council is spearheading an ambitious drive to get an artist into every K-8 school in the county. This academic year, Chatham Arts Council's Artist in Schools initiative, which is funded by the council, has grown from just 2 artists in 2 schools to nearly 20 artists in 14 schools. Others involved in the program include Afrofuturist hip-hop, rap, jazz, soul, and poetry program Black Space with Grammy-nominated Pierce Freelon, Flamenco with dance company Flamenco Vivo, Carlota Sanjana, and poetry with poet Philip Shabazz. The residency program seeks to use art to enhance student engagement with traditional subjects like history, science, and math. Wiley's play, A Game Apart, about Jackie Robinson, for instance, teaches history alongside themes of resilience by looking at the baseball players' childhood years. Wiley says they're all able to see themselves in Jackie and the experiences that made him the person that he was, and they see the triumphs as well as the failures. When you see that someone had fallen off a horse a number of times, gotten back onto that horse an equal amount of times, you too can see yourself walking in those shoes. Students also learned about tough subjects like segregation through Wiley's Robinson play. "I've had students ask, 'Does this mean that my mother and father would not have been able to get married?'" says Wiley. "I am able to answer those questions. And then their teachers are able to fill in even more afterward. So it's a lovely relationship that arts educators are able to build with students." While the length of each artist residency varies, Wiley usually spends a week in a given class, first performing one of his own plays, then working with the students to create a performance of their own. After the residency at Bennett School last season, Principal Dr. Carla Neal wrote a thank you letter to the Chatham Arts Council saying, "Our community faces the geographic challenge of not being in the area where there are opportunities for students to engage in positive arts or enrichment activities. Doing this workshop during the school day was an experience that allowed all students to positively interact with professional artists they might otherwise never experience." Wiley agrees it's the ambition of the Arts Council, which is a relatively small organization with an emphasis on connecting children to the arts, that makes this residency a success. And he says, "To be able to accomplish what they accomplish every year is, in a sense, unheard of." A Durham civil rights icon, Pauli Murray, is more or less profiled here in this article. The first time Angela Thorpe Mason heard of Durham civil rights activist Pauli Murray was close to 10 years ago. Her reaction was one of confusion, curiosity, and a complete awe, culminating in a question, "Why have I never heard of Pauli Murray?" At the time, Mason was a contract curator with the Museum of Durham History, working on an exhibit on the history of the baseball card. Stuck in a rut, she visited the Scrap Exchange, where a Pauli Murray exhibit was on display. The exhibit inspired the current project she was working on, and Pauli Murray also stayed with her. Mason, now the executive director for the Pauli Murray Center for History and Social Justice, says, "This is certainly a full circle moment. It's wonderful that Pauli has stood on my shoulder now for a decade." The Center for History and Social Justice, located in Murray's childhood home on Carroll Street, that's 906 Carroll Street, opened its door to the public on September the 7th, following almost 10 years of renovation. Built in 1898 by Murray's maternal grandparents, the house was slated for demolition for many years, Mason says. A few different organizations oversaw the property till the center was established back in 2012. Community support and fundraising, which includes a $1.6 million grant for the Andrew Mellon Foundation, have contributed to its rehabilitation. Born in 1910, Murray was a pioneering queer lawyer, writer, priest, activist, and passionate scholar of gender, race, and equality. Throughout their life, Murray questioned their gender, changing their birth name of Anna Pauline to the androgynous Pauli upon graduating from Hunter College in 1933. They were repeatedly denied gender-affirming medical care. In this story, parenthetically, the Indy is using gender-neutral pronouns per the Pauli Center, though Murray's family members also use she and her. Murray's identity and interests were racially broad. Now, the Pauli Murray Center's goal is to welcome people of all identities and to make sure that everyone has heard of Pauli Murray. The center is on the National Register of Historic Places, and Mason hopes it will be a generative space for the Durham community. People can come sit on the house's porch, she suggests, or gather in the rooms that Murray grew up in, pursuing work aligned with Murray's visions. One group that frequents the center is the Affordable Housing Building Collective, a group working to reimagine home models that draws inspiration from Murray's legacy. The center will also facilitate programming grounded in social justice, says Mason, and will continue partnering with different organizations to provide resources to Durham residents. One ongoing partnership is with the North Carolina Bar Foundation, which has helped provide pro bono services to members of the LGBTQ community. Mason says Pauli was so expansive that there is a point of entry for almost anyone to connect with Pauli. Rosita Stevens Holsey, Murray's oldest living niece, grew up visiting Murray from Washington, D.C. The nation's capital became a meeting place for most of their family, and Stevens Holsey says one of her fondest memories was seeing Murray with their guard down. I saw her put her feet up, smoke a cigarillo, smoke a pipe, which is something she did often, or probably in public, but she was a smoker like my mother, Stevens Holsey said of her aunt, who she says was a lover of dogs and reading. Stevens Holsey would regularly mail letters to Murray, who would mail them back with red circles, correcting grammar and punctuation. It was a family thing, says Stevens Holsey. They were always exceedingly interested in education, proper English, proper etiquette. But I was drawn to her especially because of her brilliance. Both Stevens Holsey and Murray were travelers. Stevens Holsey has visited 49 states and 50 countries and, like Murray, travels to explore new topics and learn about different cultures. But while Murray's travels took them all over, their family home in Durham has become the heart of their legacy. West End, the historically black and working-class neighborhood where Murray grew up, is rapidly changing, Mason says, making the responsibility to maintain the history of the home and neighborhood all the more important. The center is held in a land bank, meaning it's preserved. But Mason says parts of the neighborhood that are not in the land bank are being redeveloped. Mason sees the center and the West End neighborhood as sacred space. Growing up in Edgecombe County herself and the descendant of enslaved people, the center's history means everything to her. Mason says, I think it's really important to ground folks in the reality of what and who was here. Stevens Holsey said she had what she considers her Polly Murray epiphany almost a decade ago. It was 2016, and she'd traveled to Durham at a church event. Everybody shared stories about Murray. I became overwhelmed, says Stevens Holsey. I've never been in a situation where someone, not only that I knew, but someone who is a part of my family, was held in such regard. She heard from people who personally knew Murray and people who were just influenced by their work. People came up to her asking to touch her because she had the same blood as Murray and shared stories of how Murray made them feel. She says, I was started having an out-of-body experience. It just all came over me. I was amazed. Mason knows that with Murray's legacy, there is also great responsibility, and she doesn't take it lightly. Quote, it's a space that I steward with great care, and it feels like a privilege to steward. She says she hopes the center will be a center for history and social justice. Continuing, not a museum, not just a historic site, but a place where we can leverage history to catalyze people to move contemporary social justice and social change work forward. All right, here's an interesting article connected to none of those things. More or less, it's connected to birds, chimney swifts to be precise, in Chapel Hill. It's almost unnoticeable at first. A chittering sound here, a glimpse there, but within the span of half an hour, the sky over UNC Chapel Hill's McCorkle Place is full of them, thousands upon thousands of tiny, dark shapes, descending on the quad, drowning out those last cicadas of summer with their own cacophony. As the flying creatures circle a single tree at the center of the quad, even students stop to gawk. What's going on? Are they bats? The mysterious creatures are not bats. They're chimney swifts coming in to roost. The throngs of birds circle ever closer to the ground and then one by one funnel into the hollow center of that iconic Davy poplar tree. The display is almost threatening. A tornado of birds it's no surprise it conjures Halloween-like images of swarming bats. It's a planet Earth-level spectacle of nature right on the UNC campus. Now, chimney swifts are small, insect-eating migratory birds that inhabit the East Coast during the summer before migrating back to South America for the winter. In Chapel Hill, they tend to linger from late March through October, but these mass roosting events do not start until August, after they've raised their young. From August through October, triangle birders flock to the swift viewing events in Durham, Raleigh, and now Chapel Hill. The New Hope Bird Alliance, formerly New Hope Audubon, is hosting two swift nights out at Davy Poplar in conjunction with the Avian Society, UNC Chapel Hill. One is coming right up September 18th, another on October 2nd. Among the fastest flyers in the world, chimney swifts clock at a rate of almost 60 miles per hour. They spend the days flying before coming to roost en masse overnight. Historically, swifts huddled in the hollows of trees like Davy Poplar, where they roost in the thousands to conserve their body heat when the nights begin to grow colder. Then the Europeans arrived to settle the Americas. Deforestation and urbanization wiped out many of the trees suitable for roosting habitats. Because chimney swifts are unable to perch like most birds, and must cling to vertical surfaces to rest, the species resorted to nesting and roosting in chimneys, hence the name chimney swift. The eradication of this species' ancestral roosting sites is so complete that the Davy Poplar could very well be the only documented case in the state of swifts roosting in a tree, according to Barbara Driscoll, the New Hope Bird Alliance member who discovered the site. Driscoll says, "I've been trying to find any information about other trees, and nobody has any real data on other trees being used." She's been counting swifts in downtown Chapel Hill since 2017. After a career with the Environmental Protection Agency, she's been a member of New Hope Bird Alliance since she and her husband, Thomas, moved into the Triangle in 1996. A former president of the group, she's now the chair of their Conservation Committee and a co-chair of the Bird Friendly Habitat Committee. Counting the birds, which can number into the thousands, is no easy task, especially since the best time to do it is after sunset. She says, usually you start counting by ones, then tens and twenties, and then you're estimating by kind of grouping them as they drop in. One night in 2023, in September, Driscoll was out on a swift count at Porthole Alley on Franklin Street, where chimney swifts had been known to roost in nearby chimneys. New Hope Bird Alliance had been concerned about a sudden drop in count numbers the previous years. She says, "I was really worried about that just in general. The numbers were dropping, and I'd gone to do a count there because that's one of our typical locations, and there were only three birds, and they just kind of flew around and they flew off. And I thought, well, that's really weird, but I could still hear birds." She followed the sound of the birds to McCorkle Place. Thousands of them circled above the quad, but she couldn't figure out where they were going. "I was thinking, well, what chimney are they going into?" Then she realized they weren't circling a chimney at all. They were funneling into the Davy Poplar. That tree, likely already more than a century old when the cornerstone of the university was laid in 1793, is a symbol of the university. Legend has it, when Davy Poplar falls, the university will fall with it. This is precisely why the Tulip Poplar remains standing, to serve as a place to rest for thousands of swifts. Struck by lightning in 1873, any other tree would likely have been felled long ago. And Driscoll says, "We're just lucky that it's the Davy Poplar." The swifts are lucky, too. Having lost access to their original tree roosts, swifts are almost entirely reliant on human structures to roost through these cool fall nights and raise their chicks. While thousands of birds might share a chimney to roost early on in the season, only one pair will use a given chimney to nest and raise their young. With chimneys falling out of fashion due to the advent of central heating and air conditioning, chimney swifts are left with fewer and fewer viable places to raise their young. This, along with the decline of insects, has led to a precipitous decline in chimney swift populations over the years. According to American Bird Conservancy's State of the Birds report, the chimney swift is among an unfortunate list of bird species that have lost 50% of their population from 1970 to 2019 and are at risk of losing another 50% in the next 50 years. Homeowners can mitigate the loss of populations by leaving suitable chimneys made of brick or another rough surface uncapped for swifts to use year-round, or at least during the breeding season from mid-March through the summer. Artificial towers can also be constructed in backyards or as projects with local churches, parks, schoolyards, and other public places. Turning off lights at night while swifts and other summer migrants are passing through from August through November also reduces the risk of window strikes, which can kill hundreds of swifts at a time. Durham, Raleigh, and Chapel Hill have all instituted lights-out policies to protect migratory birds. Haven Wiley, a professor of ecology and biology at UNC Chapel Hill, has been compiling breeding bird surveys in the area for years. He says local chimney swift populations have dropped to about 40% of what they were 25 years ago. The Davy Poplar has stood as a campus landmark for hundreds of years. If well taken care of, it could serve as a respite for the chimney swift for a few centuries more, giving visitors and students alike a chance to experience an incredible natural spectacle for generations to come. Driscoll says, I think most people have absolutely no idea about nature, and they kind of see it as something that's over there, or you go to a state park and it's there, or a national park. But you know, nature is all around us, all the time. Finally, there is a new book coming out in October of 2024 from UNC Press. I will not be able to read even most of this article about it, but the title of it is Anatomy of a Purple State, UNC Press, by Chris Cooper. And the article begins, Chris Cooper rarely struggles to answer an interview question. From the state's first constitution to last week's voter registration number, North Carolina's resident political pundit is always prepared to discuss anything. But he felt like his answers to one question, what book would he recommend for a rundown on North Carolina politics, were a bit outdated. So he wrote it. Cooper, the Madison Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Public Affairs and Director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western Carolina University, researches and teaches American politics with an emphasis on North Carolina and has been quoted about state politics in just about every major and minor news outlet in the country, including this one. In Anatomy of a Purple State, Cooper tries to make sense of the patterns and players of Tar Heel state politics. His credentials are not only as an expert but a teacher shine through as he mixes the accessibility of sports analogies with a strong eye to the state's love of college basketball with witty turns like accidental anathema of architecture to describe Raleigh's unfortunate legislative building. Cooper also knows his limits. He doesn't pretend his book contains all the answers and concludes it with a list of other books journal articles, data sources, even podcasts to look at for more information. He hopes, he says, that Anatomy of a Purple State can draw in anyone curious about how the old North State works and in part help address our increasing obsession with national politics at the expense of state politics. I would recommend that people go to IndyWeek.com to read this whole. I'll only have chance for one Q&A, I think, from this article. Since we're starting the school year, they ask, is there anything you're teaching now that you wouldn't have taught, say, before 2016? How has teaching politics changed? And his answer, there are probably things I'm teaching now I wouldn't have taught 1 month ago. I wouldn't have talked about unaffiliated voters as a key part of our state, but yet, that's what most of our students are. Obviously, for good, bad, or indifferent, Donald Trump has changed the national environment, and that includes North Carolina. So the way I talk about ticket splitting has changed. It's a bit of a head-scratcher to think, here's a state that voted for Trump and Roy Cooper on the same ballot. It wasn't two different cycles or different ties. It was the same ballot. I talk about party switching. Tricia Cotham's party switch really reinforced how much party switching does matter, so I want to orient students to that. I talk about the Council of State more than I used to as well, not so much because the environment's changed, but because I'm increasingly realizing that people don't have a clue of the difference between the auditor or the treasurer, for example. Well, this article I must regretfully stop because it is fascinating. I suggest people who are interested in this book look for its release in October. Go to, for more of this interview, to IndyWeek.com and check it out. But meanwhile, Mr. Clock is ticking my way towards a close. John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service, having read another week's edition of Indie Week, The Independent. And we hope you'll return. This broadcast goes into our file of podcasts, which is always available after the fact. And I hope that you'll come back next week or whenever it's convenient and to hear the next edition. So, John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long, and thanks to listening for Indie Week.